In a milestone win for civil society, the EU will withdraw from the Climate Tracking Energy Charter Treaty, or ECT.
You're listening to EU Watchdog Radio.
The ECT was designed in the 1990s to favor industry's interests and was a powerful weapon to obstruct the kind of phase-out of fossil fuels needed to avoid catastrophic climate change. It should never have existed in the first place. Hi, welcome. I'm Joana Lausanne, Comms Officer at Corporate Europe Observatory, or CEO. In this episode of EU Watchdog Radio, I will talk to Pia Eberhardt, former campaigner and researcher at CEO, and Lucia Barcena, project coordinator at the Transnational Institute, or TNI, to celebrate the decision of the EU to finally leave the Energy Charter Treaty. I'm going to name a series of institutions now, but bear with me as it explains the sequence of events that led to leaving the ECT. So, the European Parliament's International Trade Committee voted in early April to adopt the Commission's proposal that the EU withdraw from the Energy Charter Treaty. The Belgian EU presidency reached a deal with the European Commission and member states on the EU's withdrawal from the ECT, and this has now been approved by the European Parliament. In this episode, I will alternate the interviews between Pia and Lucia. Try not to get lost between them. Before I pass it over to them, it's worth recommending the reading of a report co-written by CEO and TNI called One Treaty to Rule Them All, which was maybe the first in-depth report ever done about the ECT and its consequences. Another big acronym that will be mentioned is ISDS, which stands for Investor State Dispute Settlement, and it is a mechanism present in several international trade agreements, and it was the cornerstone of the ECT. ISDS specifies a set of rules through which countries can be sued by foreign investors for actions affecting their investments. Pia will start by providing a particularly outrageous example of how this was used by the ECT. Over to her.
Let's start from the beginning. The Energy Charter Treaty was established in the mid-90s. So what exactly is it, and what implications, what consequences does it have?
So the Energy Charter Treaty is a very big trade and investment agreement. It applies to around 50 countries. So nearly all the EU members, for example, many states in Central Asia, but also Japan. So it is a very big agreement. And one set of rules that it has allows foreign investors in the energy sector to sue the ECT member states when they do something that allegedly harms their investment. So very well known are two cases, for example, that the Swedish company Vattenfall filed against Germany. One was because there was a coal-fired power plant where the local government in Germany put in place some environmental restrictions. So Vattenfall sued Germany over that. And Vattenfall also sued Germany when Germany got out of phased out nuclear power after the Fukushima nuclear disaster. And what's special about these lawsuits is that they don't happen in proper courts. So, for example, in this case, in the courts of Germany or Sweden or an EU court, but they take place in a parallel crazy legal system that is very much tilted towards the interests of corporations. And this is what makes it so dangerous, this agreement, because the legal regime is biased in favor of the interests of corporations. States can end up being ordered paying like very big amounts of money. And this has the effect that it is a big incentive for states to not do what they should do. So to delay action, to weaken it a little bit, or maybe don't do anything at all in the energy sector. And this includes very important measures that we all know have to be taken to advance the energy transition. So this is what makes this agreement so particularly dangerous in delaying or attacking the energy transition.
A very obvious example where you can see the impact is when Italy, the government of Italy, decided to remove a license that they had given to an oil exploration company in the seaside of the Italy's shore. So they retired this license because of environmental issues, and also after like huge protests happened in the community where the oil exploration was gonna take place. And when they retired the license, then the oil corporation, which is a UK-based company called Rockhopper, they initiated a lawsuit against Italy because of this measure, alleging that they would lose profits because of Italy's doing. So this is like one of the examples that I think it shows very well how this treaty was only there to protect private corporations' interests, and in specific fossil fuel interests, in detriment of the community's livelihoods and environment and other like social and environmental important issues.
In 2018, you co-authored, at the time with CEO and TNI, a report. So what exactly arose your interest in the Energy Charter Treaty, and what were like the key discoveries that you made with that report?
Well, at the time when we started working on the report, so that was a little bit before 2018 because it took us forever, this whole issue of investors suing states in their own legal system was very big, because we had this very big movement against the EU-US trade deal, TTIP, where this regime was also planned for. So many activists and even the public knew about this regime. And some people also knew about the Energy Charter Treaty, for example, because they knew about these infamous cases of Vattenfall against Germany. So it was known, but it was not known at the same time. It was a bit dubious, mysterious legal regime. So we didn't know much. We knew it was important, but we didn't know much. And in that situation, a colleague who works for an organization that advises many developing countries when they get sued by corporations, she basically warned me. She said, well, you might not know, but the Energy Charter Treaty, this very dangerous agreement for the energy transition, is about to be expanded to many new countries. So in particular, developing countries in Africa, in Latin America and Asia. So apparently, EU member states that were already a member of the Energy Charter Treaty and the secretariat that was administering this agreement, but also the lawyers that make a lot of money when these lawsuits happen, they were touring around Africa and Asia and telling governments, oh, there's this fantastic agreement. If you sign on to it, it will bring you many investments. This is what you need. But no one knew about this expansion process. And this is actually what made us interested in it, because we realized, oh my God, this must not happen. If more countries sign on to this agreement, it will mean that more countries, you know, reduce their policy space to do the right thing. So this is actually what made us look more into the agreement, this looming expansion process. And what we found, so I did the research together with a colleague from TNI. It was indeed shocking. I think the biggest shock to us was to see how many countries were actually slowly and silently, without anyone knowing, in this process to accede to the Energy Charter Treaty. How many countries in Africa, and Asia, and a couple of them also in Latin America, while there was no debate in these countries, no public debate, and the people in the countries who might have known about the risks, the financial and political risks of joining such an agreement, they were not involved, because trade and investment ministries and the people working there, they were not involved in these discussions. It was just people from energy ministries. So this was really shocking, and we felt, oh my God, we're probably too late. We probably cannot stop this anymore. But there were so many other shocking things. I mean, to understand how dangerous the Energy Charter Treaty as an agreement is, because its legal terms are so shitty. They're so bad. They're so badly explained, for example. And when you have something that is very badly explained, lawyers can just make everything out of it. So we also understood the tremendous legal risks in this agreement a lot. And then also how small and powerful the little clique, the little group of people was that were basically filling their pockets with this agreement and then touring to Africa to convince others. So it was really just a few lawyers, a few law firms, and government officials, and this shady secretariat of the Energy Charter Treaty, which is based in Brussels. So the interconnections, the conflicts of interest, that was also really, really, really shocking. Yeah. So in overall, it felt like, I don't know, really a time bomb, ticking time bomb, this agreement.
Yeah, it really makes us wonder, what the hell were they thinking when they signed up for it? But I guess, like you said, maybe they didn't think of the nasty consequences that it would have.
Well, we know that when signing this agreement, there's always like a big industry lobby behind, convincing the negotiator to agree on most of the text that they're signing, right? So I think like we can only understand this if we understand the lobby side of corporations that are like, you know, sitting next to policymakers and advising on policies that they have to sign. And of course, this doesn't like take away the responsibility of policymakers who are signing and negotiating these agreements. But, you know, it's important to just have these two, these two figures and these power dynamics in mind, which is the public and the private sitting together and, yeah, negotiating trade agreements.
And ever since, like, it was a huge treaty, like, there have had many, many countries signing into it. And for a while, there was talk about expansion for other countries in the global south. So what happened in the meantime to have made it so unpopular? So what has led to this outcome that we're living now, with so many countries announcing that they will drop out from it?
The governments were not really aware of the treaty that they had signed to until we started to shed some light on the specific cases and ISDS and making the linkages very clear towards how being part of this agreement would be a huge obstacle for climate policy development. And that's when policymakers started to look at what this agreement was actually about. And they started to take notice and they started to take it a bit more serious. This wasn't immediate. Of course, this was only possible because there was civil society pressure behind, and there were like movements and campaigns, and we did a lot of actions. We're talking about a campaign that has always almost been like 4 year long. So it wasn't like immediate, it was slow, but the process was there. And initially, like, the countries that had like most cases against them under the ACT, they were the ones that started to raise the voices in the different European institutions, right? But I mean, we can say two things, right? On the one side, the cases that had to do with environmental policy, the countries like were very concerned about this. And on the other side, the governments were concerned that they were going to have to pay millions and millions of euros to foreign investors due to their own policy making. And this is like, yeah, we can say this is a bit hypocritical because this is like a practice that actually the EU has been doing in other countries in the world. And no policymaker has ever come out and said that this is an unjust system. But now because it went against them, like against the EU countries, that's what made them like, you know, want to end this agreement. So I think this is like one of the challenges that we have now, which is to you know, to point out and take notice that the ACT is only one of almost 3,000 bilateral investment treaties that include ISDS and that also give access to fossil fuel corporations to initiate lawsuits and mining and extractive corporations. And I think that's like the challenge that we now have as European civil society to make sure that this is not only a EU matter, but like a global justice issue.
And I mean, doing this kind of research is so important because, as you were saying, the all the negotiations, all the conversations happen behind the curtains and behind the public eye. So in fact, like the Energy Charter Treaty and the few people who profited a lot from it have managed to escape public attention, but since 2023, several countries have announced that they were going to leave or have left the ECT. So how do you feel about that?
Actually, I feel pretty good about it. I'm tremendously happy, actually, that we, and with that, with we, I mean, really many people, the whole movement, activists in Europe, but also critical lawyers, journalists, you know, got interested in the ECT. So politicians, you know, that asked the right questions. So it was a large group of people in the end who managed to politicize something that was simply not politicized before. So that what makes me very happy, and that it led not only to publicity and attention and public debate in the media, but to actually meaningful legal steps, namely withdrawal. I think that's a huge victory. It's legally, it's not so difficult to leave such an agreement, but politically, the powers you're up against are huge. I mean, the interest, the profit interests in this agreement were very big, but also this whole, you know, neoliberal fetish of trade and investment agreements, and if you don't join or if you leave, you're a nationalist. I mean, it's a very powerful discourse to stand up against. So I'm really happy that this wall has been broken, so to say, but I'm probably even more happy, or at least as happy, that no new countries joined the ACT, because as I told you, we felt a bit in 2080s, shit, we're too late. We cannot stop this rolling out of this agreement all over Africa and Latin America and Asia. But we did it. Since 2018, no new country has signed on to this agreement. So yeah, I guess it's a big victory.
Do you think this will really be the end of the ECT, or do you think that they will do some kind of repack? I mean, like you said, there are many, many other treaties around the world. So what do you think? Do you think we can really celebrate, or?
Well, honestly, we're a bit like now even surprised that we are in the same position as the European Commission. For the first time, we agree on a policy. The European Commission is actually pushing for not only the EU, but all EU member states to withdraw from the ACT. The European Commission doesn't want a mess out of this, like a legal mess. They want all of the European member countries to just withdraw from the treaty and put an end to this legal nightmare, basically. But there are some countries in the European Union that are not so sure that they want to get out of the treaty. So they are saying that that they would like to continue being part of the agreement, even if the EU leaves and even if almost all of the member countries leave. So this is what is going to be solved in the next days. We're going to see in the 22nd of April, the week of the 22nd of April, there's going to be a plenary vote in the European Parliament where we are like very sure that the vote is going to be casted to, you know, like to vote in favor of leaving the ECT. But after that, it has to go in the European Council. And that's when we're going to see what the different countries have to say. So we do expect that after this big push of the EU to exit the ECT, these countries are going to see clear that the ECT has absolutely no benefits for them to be part of, and it's just going to bring a huge mess and a lot of new ISDS cases, and they're going to probably, you know, move a bit more on the side of withdrawing from the ECT. But this doesn't mean that the ECT is dead. This only means that the EU and a lot of EU member countries are out of the ECT, but there are 53 members of the ECT, and those other members that are not EU specific, they have not said anything in the sense of that they would like to withdraw from the ECT. So we have to see if there is going to be move towards reviving the treaty and expanding to other countries. And that's where we have to put our efforts now to guarantee that the ECT dies in Europe, where it was also born.
Yes. And just a curiosity that I have, after a country leaves the ECT, can they still be sued?
Yeah, so this is one of the biggest concerns that even if you, I mean, biggest concerns and also one of the flaws and the abuse that you can see of the ECT, which is that even if you leave the treaty, there is like a 20-year extension clause or zombie clause that keeps the treaty alive, and specifically the investment protection part. So countries can still be subject to ISDS cases even after they leave, but there is an important but here, because they can be subject to ISDS cases on the investment made prior to exiting the ECT, but not any new investment will be covered after the countries leave the ECT. So that's a big gain already. And secondly, there are still like discussions to be made on if it's going to be possible to sign some kind of like inter-se agreement among the countries that left the ECT to annul, to neutralize like the access to international arbitration. This is possible because this has been made in other international treaties. So this is something that countries are exploring. And that would basically mean that, I don't know, around 80-90% of ISDS cases that have actually been already initiated would not be possible to initiate anymore because they're EU-based, like from a EU member country.
We started this episode by mentioning ISDS and the Rockhopper versus Italy case that Lucia mentioned. It is actually often referred to as one of the most ridiculous examples of ECT. Rockhopper didn't have any facilities in place, it had done no construction, and still it sued Italy for future profits for $250 million. An arbitration tribunal ordered in their favor, and Italy had to pay them 190 million euros for lost for hypothetical future profits. The 1990s were peak neoliberal years. Just as with the ECT, many other problematic treaties and European legislation were forged in that era that lock in corporate privileges and create obstacles for the socially just ecological transition Europe needs. It's not just the ECT and other international investment treaties enabling ISDS, but all of these outdated approaches that need an urgent revision. Europe really has to learn some important lessons from the ECT. In the same way that the EU has finally recognized that the ECT is incompatible with the Paris Agreement and its own climate targets, it needs to apply the same logic to many other areas, from single market rules to better regulation, which put the needs of investors and corporations over all other considerations. Indeed, if the EU is serious about tackling climate change and ecosystem breakdown, it really needs to roll back the kind of corporate capture of EU policymaking that we see endemic in many crucial areas. We need public policies to quickly and equitably phase out fossil fuels, but lobbyists from the coal, oil, and gas industries are slowing us down to protect their own profits. That means not just removing these neoliberal structures, withdrawal from the ECT being just the first step. We also need a firewall between these dirty energy lobbyists and political decision-making. We have come to the end of this podcast. If you like it and you appreciate the work of CEO, please help us stay independent. Sign into our newsletter at corporateeurope.org and follow us on social media. You can also listen to our brand new podcast series called What is Going Wrong and How to Put It Right. Till next time, bye-bye.